kindred souls, and this is one of the things that determined my future path toward becoming a musician. I started to meet people who knew about Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, and they had older friends, record collectors, who would hold club nights, which is where I was first introduced to John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, and Little Walter. These guys would get together in one of their houses and spend the whole evening listening to one album, like The Best of Muddy Waters, and then have excited discussions about what they'd heard. Clive and me would often go up to London to visit record stores like Imhoff's on New Oxford Street, the whole of whose basement was devoted to jazz, and Dobell's on Shaftesbury Avenue, where they had a bin devoted to Folkways, which was the major label for folk, blues, and traditional music. If you were lucky, you'd meet a working musician in one of these stores, and if you told them that you liked Muddy Waters, they might say, "Well, then you've got to listen to Lightning Hopkins," and you'd be off in a new direction. Music began to take up so much of my life that it was no surprise that my work at art school began to suffer. It was my own fault that things went this way, because initially I had been really gripped by the experience of getting involved in a life in art. I was quite hooked by painting, and to a certain extent by design. I was a good draftsman, and when I enrolled at Kingston, they had offered me a place in their graphics department, which I accepted, rather than going into fine art. But once I'd got into the graphics department, I knew that I was in the wrong place, and I dropped out. My motivation died. I'd go into the canteen at lunch and see all the students come in from fine art, long-haired, covered in paint, and looking completely detached. They were given almost total freedom, developing their talents as painters or sculptors, while I was set to do projects every day, designing a soapbox or coming up with an advertising campaign for a new product. Apart from a short period when I managed to get into the glass department, where I learned engraving and sandblasting and became quite interested in contemporary stained glass, I was bored to tears. Music was 10 times more exciting, 10 times more engaging, and as much as I loved art, I also felt that the people who were trying to teach me were coming from an academic direction that I just couldn't identify with. It seemed to me that I was being prepared for a career in advertising, not art, where salesmanship would be just as important as creativity. Consequently, my interest and my output dwindled down to nothing. I was still shocked, however, when I went for my assessment at the end of the first year and was told that they had decided not to keep me on. I knew my portfolio was a bit thin, but I really believed that the work I had done was good enough to get me through. To me, it was much more creative and imaginative than most of the other students' work. But they were judging by quantity, and they booted me and one other student out, just 2 of us out of 50. Which was not good. I was totally unprepared for it, but it threw me back into using the only other talent I had. Being thrown out of art school was another rite of passage for me. I got brought up short by the sudden realization that all doors weren't going to open up for me for the rest of my life, that the truth was that some of them were going to close. Emotionally and mentally, the shit hit the fan. When I finally found the courage to tell Rose and Jack, they were bitterly disappointed and ashamed, because they found out that I was a liar as well as a failure. Many times when I had told them I was at school, I was actually playing hooky, just wandering around playing the guitar or hanging out in a pub drinking. "You've had your chance, Rick," Jack said to me, "and now you've chucked it away." He made it quite clear that if I intended to stay living with them, I would be expected to work and bring money into the house. If I didn't contribute, that I could get out. I chose to work, and accepted a job working for Jack as his mate at £15 a week, which was a good wage. Jack was a master plasterer, a master bricklayer, and a master carpenter. In layman's terms, this means he had mastered all of these trades and was entitled to the wages and respect this commanded. Working for someone as elevated as this was no laughing matter, of course. It meant mixing up lots of plaster, mortar and cement, and getting it to him quickly so that he could lay bricks and put up plaster without taking his eyes off the job. One of the first big jobs we did together was at a primary school in Chobham, and the most demanding work for me was carrying semi-liquid mortar in a hod, up a ladder, and onto a scaffold as quickly as my body would allow, so that Jack could lay a true line of bricks. I got extremely fit, and I really did love the work, probably because I knew it would not last forever. My grandfather really was brilliant with his hands, and watching him plaster an entire wall in minutes was exhilarating. It turned out to be a valuable experience, even though it seemed he was being extra tough on me, which I'm sure he was because he wanted no suspicion of nepotism. I learned that he worked and lived from a very strong set of principles, which he tried to pass on to me. In those days there were two schools of thought on a building site. The first was that you did as little as you could, but got away with it by making the foreman think you were really busy when you were in fact skiving. This seemed to be the norm. The second, as personified by Jack, was that you worked consistently to a rhythm and did a good job until you had finished it. He had no time for skivers, and so, to a certain extent, like me in later years, he was slightly unpopular and a bit of an outcast. His legacy to me was that I should always try to do my best, and always finish what I started. All the time I was working on my playing, sometimes almost driving my family mad with the repetitiveness of my practicing. I was addicted to music, and by now I also had a record collection. Listening to Chuck Berry, B.B. King, and Muddy Waters had turned me on in a big way to electric blues, and somehow I had managed to persuade my grandparents to buy me an electric guitar. This happened after I had been up to London to see Alexis Corner playing at the Marquee on Oxford Street, a jazz club that had occasional blues nights. Alexis had been the first real R&B band in the country, with a fantastic harmonica player named Cyril Davies. Watching Alexis play for the first time made me think that there was no reason why an electric guitar shouldn't be available to me. Another good reason why I so desperately needed a new guitar was that my Washburn was broken beyond repair. Before I started working for Jack, Rose had decided to take me to visit my mum for a few days. She was then living on an Air Force base near Bremen, Germany, where her husband Frank, or Mac as I called him, was stationed. She now had three children. A second daughter, Heather, was born in 1958. Almost as soon as I arrived, Mac told me that I would have to get my hair cut before I could go into the mess. I was horrified by this request, since my hair was not even particularly long by the standards of the day, but it seemed that the offensive part was that you couldn't see the top of my ears. I looked to the younger generation in the form of my three half-siblings for support, but found none there. One by one they came after me too. I was adamant about not doing it until Rose also joined their ranks, which broke my heart, because up until then she had always been my staunchest defender, whatever the situation. I gave in, but it made me very angry, as it seemed like I no longer had anyone on my side. They gave me a crew cut, and I felt alone and humiliated. I moped around a lot for the remainder of my stay, but things only got worse. One day I was sulking on my bed in the spare room when my half-brother Brian came in and sat down on the bed without looking. He sat down right on top of my beloved Washburn guitar, which was lying there, and broke the neck clean in half. I could see immediately that it was beyond repair. And I was gutted. He was the sweetest kid, totally in awe of me, and it was an accident, but there and then I vowed internally that Pat and her entire family could go to hell. I didn't lose my temper. I just withdrew. Not only had my identity been ripped away, but my most treasured possession had been destroyed. I went inside of myself, and decided that from then on, I would trust nobody. The electric guitar I chose was one I had had my eye on in the window of Bell's, where we had got the Hoyer. It was the same guitar I had seen Alexis Corner playing, a double cutaway semi-acoustic K, which at the time was quite an advanced instrument, although essentially, as I later learned, it was still only a copy of the best guitar of the day, the Gibson ES-335. It was cut away on both sides of the neck to allow easy access up the neck to the higher frets. You could play it acoustically or plug it in and play electric. The Gibson would have cost over £100 then, I think, well beyond our reach, while the K cost only £10, but still seemed quite exotic. It captured my heart. The only thing that wasn't quite right with it was the colour, though advertised as sunburst, which would have been a golden orange going to dark red at the edges, it was more yellowy, going to a sort of pink. So as soon as I got it home, I covered it with black Fablon. Much as I loved this guitar, I soon found out that it wasn't that good. It was just as hard to play as the Hoyer, because again the strings were too high off the fingerboard, and because there was no truss rod, the neck was weak. So after a few months' hard playing, it began to bow, something I had to adapt to, not having a second instrument. Something more profound also happened when I got this guitar. As soon as I got it, I suddenly didn't want it any more. This phenomenon was to rear its head throughout my life and cause many difficulties. We hadn't bought an amplifier, so I could only play it acoustically and fantasize about what it would sound like, but it didn't matter. I was teaching myself new stuff all the time. Most of the time I was trying to play like Chuck Berry or Jimmy Reed, electric stuff. Then I sort of worked backward into country blues. This was instigated by Clive, when, out of the blue, he gave me an album to listen to called King of the Delta Blues Singers, a collection of 17 songs recorded by bluesman Robert Johnson in the 1930s. I read in the sleeve notes that when Johnson was auditioning for the sessions in a hotel room in San Antonio, he played facing into the corner of the room because he was so shy. Having been paralyzed with shyness as a kid, I immediately identified with this. At first, the music almost repelled me. It was so intense, and this man made no attempt to sugarcoat what he was trying to say or play. It was hardcore, more than anything I had ever heard. After a few listenings, I realized that, on some level, I had found the master, and that following this man's example would be my life's work. I was totally spellbound by the beauty and eloquence of songs like Kind-Hearted Woman, while the raw pain expressed in Hellhound on My Trail seemed to echo things I had always felt. I tried to copy Johnson, but his style of simultaneously playing a disjointed bass line on the low strings, rhythm on the middle strings, and lead on the treble strings while singing at the same time was impossible to even imagine. I put his album to one side for a while and began listening again to other players, trying to form a style. I knew I could never reach the standards of the original guys, but I thought that if I kept trying, something would evolve. It was just a question of time and faith. I began to play things I had heard on the record, but to add my own touches. I would take the bits that I could copy from a combination of the electric blues players I liked, like John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry, and the acoustic players like Big Bill Brunsey, and amalgamate them into one, trying to find a phraseology that would encompass all these different artists. It was an extremely ambitious undertaking, but I was in no hurry, and was convinced I was on the right track, and that eventually it would come. One night in January 1963, I arranged to meet a guy named Tom McGuinness at the Prince of Wales pub in New Malden. He was playing in a blues band called The Roosters, which apparently had originally been formed by Paul Jones, with Brian Jones on guitar. When Paul and Brian left, Tom's girlfriend Jenny, who had been a fellow student of mine at Kingston School of Art, had recommended me as a possible guitarist. The lineup then consisted of Tom McGuinness on guitar, Ben Palmer on keyboards, Robin Mason on drums, and Terry Brennan on vocals. There was no bass player. Terry was a fantastic guy, a genuine, full-blown teddy boy. He had a pompadour haircut with a quiff about 6 inches high in front, and wore a fingertip jacket with a velvet collar, drainpipe jeans, and brothel creepers, which were suede winkle-picker crepe-soled shoes. Unlike most Teds, however, who had a reputation for being hard men and who only listened to Bill Haley and Jerry Lee Lewis, he was incredibly gentle. And he really loved the blues. He had a great voice, too, and it was my admiration for him and Ben, the keyboard player, that made me want to play with them. I knew Ben would be a big part of my life the minute I heard him play. He was an absolute purist, with a love for the blues that more than matched my own. I played a short audition, and they immediately asked me to join the band. The Roosters were a tiny outfit, with virtually no equipment. Guitar, vocals, keyboard, all went through one amplifier. We had no proper transport. Just Robin's Morris Oxford convertible, into which we had to pile all our equipment as well as ourselves, ownership of the car giving him a certain amount of power in the band. We met for rehearsals in a room above a pub somewhere in Surbiton. I would come up from Ripley and plug my guitar into Tom's amplifier, and we would just learn things, mostly blues and R&B covers. We taught ourselves a couple of Chuck Berry songs, Short Fat Fanny by Larry Williams, and some stuff by Muddy Waters. The most significant event for me was when Tom, one day, brought out a record by black artist Freddie King, a 45 RPM instrumental called Hideaway that he was mad about. I'd never heard Freddie King before, and listening to him had an effect on me similar to what I might feel if I were to meet an alien from outer space. It simply blew my mind. On the B-side of Hideaway was I Love the Woman, which had a guitar solo in the middle of it that took my breath away. It was like listening to modern jazz, expressive and melodic, a unique kind of playing in which he bent the strings and produced sounds that gave me the shivers. It was absolutely earth-shattering for me, like a new light for me to move toward. Up until that moment, I had always thought of guitar playing as being little more than an accompaniment to the singing, except in one or two rare cases that I had always noticed and wondered where the players were coming from. A good example of this was the Connie Francis number, Lipstick on Your Collar, which has an incredible guitar solo by George Barnes. And Ricky Nelson had a guitarist, James Burton, who would play country blues electric guitar solos. Hearing Freddy play explained where all of this had come from. The Roosters rehearsed more than we played. Even though we did a gig every now and then, mostly in upstairs rooms in pubs, it was more about the excitement of meeting like-minded blues people. Virtually nobody in Ripley had any interest in blues. Pop was the order of the day, with the current craze being the Mersey sound. The Beatles were just starting to be popular, and once a week a radio show called Pop Go the Beatles came on, which consisted entirely of them playing their own songs and covers of other people's. They were taking off really quickly, and everybody wanted to be like them. It was the beginnings of Beatlemania. All over the country, people were dressing like them, playing like them, sounding like them, and looking like them. I thought it was despicable, probably because it showed how sheep-like people were, and how ready they were to elevate these players to the status of gods, when most of the artists I admired had died unheard of, sometimes penniless and alone. It also made it look like what we were trying to do was already a lost cause. The gradual increase in popularity of the Mersey sound forced musicians like me to almost go underground, as if we were anarchists, plotting to overthrow the music establishment. It seemed that the trad jazz movement was dying, and was taking folk and blues with it. So the thing with the Roosters was that, as much as anything, we needed each other for identification. It was not like we were going anywhere, so we just met up and talked and played and had a cup of tea and compared any records we might have heard and tried to learn some of them. The repertoire was a mixture of blues numbers by John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, Freddie King and others, regular numbers being Hoochie Coochie Man, Boom Boom, Slow Down and I Love the Woman, which gave me the opportunity to show off the solos I was developing. Altogether we played no more than a dozen gigs, for a few quid and free drinks, and since I was still working on building sites for my grandfather, I would often turn up on stage covered in plaster. Most of our gigs were on the Ricky Tick Club circuit, a series of clubs in the home counties run by Philip Haywood and John Mansfield, two promoters who were into great music and who at that time had a virtual monopoly on the club scene. We also played a couple of times at the Marquee, as support to Manfred Mann, the band Paul Jones was now singing with. The truth is that, although I was having a great time, starting to make my mark as a guitarist, and enjoying the semi-bohemian lifestyle that went with it, the band was deeply flawed because it didn't really have the wherewithal, either the commitment or the money, to go anywhere. As a result, we lasted only 6 months, the final gig being at the Marquee on July 25th. Though the Marquee had made its reputation as a jazz club, where quite famous musicians like Tubby Hayes used to come and play, it was beginning to get more and more into the rhythm and blues scene. I used to go there every Thursday night, which was blues night, travelling up on the train to Waterloo, then taking the tube to Oxford Street. Since I rarely had anywhere to stay, the evening would usually end with me walking the streets till dawn, when I could catch the first train home. It was at the Marquee that I first came across John Mayall, and the saxophonist and keyboard player Graham Bond, playing in a trio with bassist Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker. Everybody in the R&B scene hung out there. After the demise of the Roosters, Tom McGuinness was approached by a Liverpudlian, Brian Casser, to join a new band. A lot of guys had been playing the Mersey clubs before the Beatles, and he was one of these. In 1959 he had fronted a group called Cass and the Casanovas, before moving down to London to run a nightclub, the Blue Gardenia in Soho. With the enormous success of the Liverpool sound, and the rapid rise of bands like Cherry and the Pacemakers, and singers like Billy J. Kramer, he had begun to feel left out, so he set about forming a new group to be called Casey Jones and the Engineers. He recruited Tom, and since I was also at a loose end, Tom recruited me. The best thing about playing with Casey Jones was the experience it gave me. It was the first time I had done any kind of touring. We played in various clubs up north, mostly round Manchester, including one open-air gig at the Bellevue Amusement Park. Cass made us all wear matching black outfits and cardboard Confederate Army caps, which both Tom and I hated. Gigs were so different then. Compared to today, the sound systems were so tiny. We would be playing through small amplifiers like Voxes or Gibsons, and we'd have one each, so most groups would then be comprised of three amps plus the drum kit. Only the most well-off groups had their own PA systems, and even those had an output of only about 100 watts, nothing by modern standards. The repertoire of the Engineers consisted of some rock and roll, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and things like that, but the majority of the material was heavily pop-based, top 20 covers, and I couldn't stand doing that for very long. I was too much of a purist, and after 6 weeks both Tom and I left. Casey Jones and the Engineers played only about 7 gigs. In between these, I was still working on building sites for my grandfather and hanging out on the local music scene, which was then blossoming. Alexis Corner had started his own club, the Ealing Club, in a cramped basement room opposite Ealing Broadway Station, while another blues enthusiast, Giorgio Gomelski, had opened the Crawdaddy Club in the old Station Hotel in Richmond, where the resident band on Sunday nights was the newly formed Rolling Stones. I'd known Mick, Keith and Brian throughout their long gestation period, when they were playing nothing but R&B. Our first meeting had been at the Marquee. It was only the second time I went to see Alexis play, and they were all there. At some point in the evening they all got up to play with Alexis's rhythm section that particular night. I got talking to Mick, and we became friends. He always used to carry a microphone in his pocket, a Reslo, and I borrowed it off him to do a gig in Richmond, which was just me and a drummer doing Chuck Berry songs. The mic had no stand, so I had to stack two chairs, one on top of the other, and tape the mic to the top of this improvised stand. Mick, Keith and Brian played wherever they could, at Ken Collier's 51 Club on Charing Cross Road, at the Marquee, and at the Ealing Club. I would occasionally stand in for Mick there, when he had a sore throat, and for a time we were all quite close. Then they got the residency at the Crawdaddy and really took off, going in 4 weeks from audiences of just a handful of people to several hundred. One night the Beatles came in to see the Stones. They'd just released Please Please Me, which was a huge hit. As they walked up and stood right in front of the stage, all of them were wearing long black leather overcoats and identical haircuts. Even then they had tremendous presence and charisma, but to me the weirdest thing was that they appeared to be wearing their stage outfits, and for some reason that bothered me. But they seemed friendly enough, and there was obviously a mutual admiration thing going on between them and the Stones, so I suppose it was only natural that I would be jealous and think of them as a bunch of wankers. Giorgio Gomelski, proprietor of the Crawdaddy, was a Georgian by birth who was brought up in France, Switzerland and Italy. A very effusive, charismatic man who peppered his speech with the word baby. He was big and round, with black hair slicked back, and a beard, a bit like Bluto with an Italian accent. Flamboyant, worldly, and a bon vivant, he also happened to love jazz and the blues, and had a fantastic ear for talent. He did an incredible amount of work for the early English R&B scene, and was, I think, the first real champion of the Stones. A few months into their stint at the Crawdaddy, they were signed up, right under his nose, by Andrew Lou Goldham, who at the time was working as a PR man for Brian Epstein, manager of the Beatles. One minute, Giorgio had the hottest club in London, featuring the hottest band in England, and the next thing he knew, they were out of the club, had put out a single, Come On, and were on tour with Bob Diddley. I think it was a disappointment that Giorgio never really got over. But he was a pragmatist, and immediately went looking for a replacement for the Sunday night slot. He eventually set his eyes on the Yardbirds, an R&B group fronted by guitarist and singer Keith Relf. Under his guidance and encouragement, they were soon making their own mark at the Crawdaddy. They had a problem, however. Their lead guitarist, 16-year-old Anthony Topham, was under severe pressure from his parents to leave the band so he could concentrate on his studies. One night I was at a party in Kingston listening to Keith and another guitarist, Roger Perko. They were playing Django Reinhardt stuff together, and really well, too, although Roger would speed it up a bit when he got excited. Keith told me he was the singer with the Yardbirds and asked if I'd like to come down and listen to them at the Crawdaddy, as their lead guitarist was likely quitting, and maybe I might be interested in taking over. I went to check them out. They were playing good R&B songs like You Can't Judge a Book by Bo Diddley and Smokestack Lightning by Howlin' Wolf, and for me, just the fact that they knew these songs was enough for me to enjoy them. Topham's guitar playing was a bit stiff, but they were a good band, if a little rough and ready, and I had nothing better to do at the time. So when Topham finally resigned, and they did eventually ask me, I said yes. I was still a bit wary about joining another group, but I genuinely thought that it would be no more than a stopgap. There were five of us. Keith on vocals and harp, Chris Drager on rhythm guitar, Paul Samuel Smith on bass, Jim McCarty on drums, and myself on lead. For the first time in my life, I now had a full-time job as a musician, which meant giving up working for my grandfather. My grandmother was delighted, as she knew where my talents lay, while my grandfather was quietly amused, so they gave me their blessing. This time there was a contract, signed in October 1963, in the front room of Keith's house in Ham, with all the parents of the band present. At first I lived at home, drawing a weekly wage packet, and commuted to rehearsals and gigs, but after a while Giorgio rented us a flat on the top floor of an old house in Kew, and we all moved in together. This was a great period for me, as it was the first time I had lived away from home. In the first few weeks before his American girlfriend arrived, I shared a room with Chris Drager, and we became really good friends. He was a quiet guy, shy and kind, and I trusted him completely. A rare thing for me. I liked the fact, too, that unlike the others, he was not driven by ambition. He was just enjoying the ride. Our gigs were all divided between various home counties venues, such as the Ricky Tick, the Star Club Croydon, and the Crawdaddy. This was my first experience of playing night after night. In the first 3 months, we played 33 gigs, and I lapped it up. What I immediately liked about being in the Yardbirds was that our entire reason for existence was to honour the tradition of the blues. We didn't write any songs at first, but the covers we chose to do defined our identity, personified in songs like Good Morning Little Schoolgirl by Sonny Boy Williamson, Got Love If You Want It by Slim Harpo, and our most popular number, which we'd play most nights, Smokestack Lightning by Howlin' Wolf. We may have thought that we could play the blues, but one man wasn't so sure. Hardly had we signed the contract when Giorgio told us that he had arranged for us to join Sonny Boy Williamson on his forthcoming tour of England. I wasn't a particular fan of Sonny Boy's. My favourite harmonica player was Little Walter, and it was not a happy experience. I knew, for example, in my role as blues expert of Ripley, that he was not the Sonny Boy Williamson who had written Good Morning, Little Schoolgirl and been killed with an ice pick, but that his real name was Rice Miller. So when we were first introduced to him at the Crawdaddy, I couldn't wait to show off and try to impress him with my knowledge, asking him, "Isn't your real name Rice Miller?" At which point he slowly pulled out a small penknife and glared at me. It went downhill from there. But he was a famous blues man, and to all intents and purposes the real thing, so we were in awe of him, and followed where he led. At one point in the show he made us kneel while he did a sort of blues moonwalk along the stage. It was more than a little strange. But he was little impressed with us too, for that matter. He is said to have commented at the time, "Those English kids want to play the blues so bad, and they play the blues so bad." I think Giorgio had an agenda from day one. What he had missed out on with the Rolling Stones he would make up for with the Yardbirds. He would take us up a notch, make us bigger than the Stones. Early in 1964 he got us signed up to Columbia Records and into a recording studio, a tiny place in New Malden called R.G. Jones, to record a cover of a song called I Wish You Would by Billy Boy Arnold. It was a simple, very catchy song, but though I thought it was great, I was in two minds about making records. I was developing a very purist attitude toward music and thought that it really ought to be just live. My theory was that making records, first and foremost, was always going to be a commercial enterprise and therefore was not pure. It was a ridiculously pompous attitude, considering that all the music I was learning from was on records. In truth, I was just embarrassed because in the studio, my own personal inadequacy was there for all to see. But it wasn't just me. And as exciting as it was to be actually making a record, when we listened back and compared it to the stuff we were supposedly modelling ourselves on, it sounded pretty lame. We just sounded young and white, and even though our second single, a cover of a rock version of Good Morning Little Schoolgirl, sounded much better, I still felt that we were falling far short of the mark in some way. This was not something I felt just about the Yardbirds, but about other bands that I admired, like Manfred Mann, the Moody Blues, and the Animals, all of whom were far better live than they were on recordings. We too were much better live, a fact borne out by the release of our first LP, 5 Live Yardbirds, which, in the absence of many other live albums, proved to be quite a groundbreaking record. It had a much rawer sound, which I was happier with. What singled us out from most other bands was the way we were experimenting with band dynamics, a direction we were taken in by Paul Samuel Smith. We became quite well known for the way in which we improvised, for example, taking the frame of a blues standard like Bo Diddley's I'm a Man, and embellishing it by jamming in the middle, usually with a staccato bass line which would get louder and louder, rising to a crescendo before coming back down again to the body of the song. While most other bands were playing 3-minute songs, we were taking 3-minute numbers and stretching them out to 5 or 6 minutes, during which time the audience would go crazy, shaking their heads around manically and dancing in various outlandish ways. On my guitar I used light-gauge guitar strings with a very thin first string, which made it easier to bend the notes, and it was not uncommon during the most frenetic bits of playing for me to break at least one string. During the pause while I was changing my string, the frenzied audience would often break into a slow hand clap, inspiring Giorgio to dream up the nickname of Slow Hand Clapton. Giorgio worked us incredibly hard. With Keith Ralph's father, Bill, as our roadie and driver, we were out on the road most nights, touring the Ricky Tick circuit and other venues in the south of England, with a trip to Abergavenny and a couple of gigs at the Twisted Wheel in Manchester thrown in for good measure. To add to our earnings and his, he once even hired us out to an advertising company to promote shirts on TV. We had our photograph taken, wearing white business shirts, while a jingle announced, "Railbrook Toplin, the shirt you don't iron." Even then, I remember feeling distinctly uncomfortable about promoting something that had nothing to do with the music. But these were the days in which musicians still had little say in what went on in their careers, and did what their managers told them. By the time we played the fourth Richmond Jazz and Blues Festival on August 9, 1964, it was our 136th gig of the year. The opening act of the weekend had been the Rolling Stones, and we closed things on Sunday night. Giorgio now pulled a bit of a fast one, a not unusual occurrence. He told us that we badly needed a holiday, and we should pack our things as we were off the next day for 2 glorious weeks in Lugano, the Swiss town on Lake Maggiore, where he had once lived. So off we went in a couple of Ford Transit vans, one of which was filled with a gaggle of female fans, girls who really loved us and would come to the Crawdaddy every week to see us, only to find that when we finally arrived at the hotel, after a hair-raising journey over the Alps, it wasn't even properly built. There was nothing on the floor, just bare concrete, and we were all staying in one room. On the second day, Giorgio announced that Bill was on his way with all the equipment, and that we were going to play by the pool. It was now quite clear that our holiday was just part of some dubious deal that he had pulled off with the hotel owner to provide cheap entertainment for the non-existent guests, and we ended up playing to a sprinkling of locals and our fans who had come out from England. By the end of 1964, after playing well over 200 gigs, we were getting a bigger and bigger following, and playing on package tours with big American stars like Jerry Lee Lewis and the Ronettes. Ronnie Ronette made a move on me one night. I couldn't believe that out of all the men on the tour, she should single out me to seduce, but it was just a momentary flirtation, and she confessed to me later that I reminded her of her husband, Phil Spector. Needless to say, I became besotted and fell head over heels in love. She was the most sexual creature I had ever laid eyes on, and I was determined to make the most of it. At the end of the tour, I hung around their hotel in London, and was utterly heartbroken when I saw her and one of the other girls in the group come out on the arms of Mick and Keith. Unlucky in love again. At the end of December, we were invited to perform as a support act to the Beatles in their 20-night series of Christmas shows at the Hammersmith Odeon in London. These were a curious mixture of music, pantomime, and comedy, in which we shared the support bill with pop groups like Freddie and the Dreamers, solo artists such as Billy J. Kramer and Elkie Brooks, and the R&B group Sounds Incorporated. The Beatles appeared in a comedy sketch with England's best-known DJ, Jimmy Savile, and generally hammed it up throughout, before playing a half-hour set at the end. Giorgio decided that we needed a uniform for the gigs. Knowing how important my image was to me and that I would fight tooth and nail to wear exactly what I wanted, he gave me the job of designing it. What I came up with were black suits with jackets that had, instead of a standard lapel, something more like a shirt lapel, which buttoned almost up to the top. We had them made up in black and in beige mohair in a workshop somewhere on Berwick Street, Soho. They were actually really nice. Even though we were quite low on the bill, playing these shows was fine for us. It was quite local, and all our followers from the Crawdaddy would come and see us, so we had our own fans to play to, and they actually listened to our music. It was different for the Beatles. One night I went to the back of the auditorium to watch them, and you couldn't hear the music at all because of the screaming. Most of their fans were young girls around the age of 12 to 15 who had no intention of listening. I felt sorry for the band, and I think they were already quite sick of it too. Hanging out backstage at the Odeon was where I had my first meeting with the Beatles. Paul played the ambassador, coming out to meet us and saying hello. I remember him playing us the tune of Yesterday, which was half written, and asking everyone what they thought. He didn't have the words yet. He was calling it Scrambled Eggs, and singing, "Scrambled eggs. Everybody calls me scrambled eggs." George and I hit it off right away. He seemed to like what I did, and we talked shop a lot. He showed me his collection of Gretsch guitars, and I showed him my light gauge strings, which I always bought from a shop called Clifford Essex on Earlham Street. I gave him some, and this was the start of what was to eventually become a long friendship, though not for a while, since the Beatles were then in another world to us. They were stars, and climbing fast. My meeting with John was a little different. One night I was on the tube travelling to Hammersmith for one of the shows, and I got talking to an elderly American woman. She was lost, and asking me for directions. She asked me what I did and where I was going, and I told her I was going to play guitar in a concert with the Beatles. "The Beatles?" she said, astonished, and then asked, "Can I come along?" "If you want to, I'll try and get you in," I replied. When we arrived at the Odeon, I told the stage manager she was a friend of mine, and took her over to the Beatles' dressing room, which was on the same level as the stage. They were getting ready to go on, but they took a moment, and were really friendly and polite to her. But when we got to John and I introduced her, he made a face of mock boredom and started doing wanking movements inside his coat. I was really shocked and quite offended because I felt responsible for this harmless little old lady. And in a sense, of course, he was insulting me. I got to know John quite well later in our lives, and we were friends, I suppose. But I was always aware that he was capable of doing some pretty weird stuff. Though the Yardbirds weren't yet in the big money league, we were making enough for me to buy my first really serious guitar, a cherry red Gibson ES-335, the instrument of my dreams, of which the K had been but a poor imitation. Throughout my life I chose a lot of my guitars because of the other people who played them, and this was like the one Freddie King played. It was the first of a new era of guitars which were thin and semi-acoustic. They were both a rock guitar and a blues guitar, which you could play, if necessary, without amplification and still hear them. I had seen the Gibson in a shop on either Charing Cross Road or Denmark Street, where several music stores had electric guitars in the windows. To me, they were just like sweet shops. I would stand outside, staring at these things for hours on end, especially at night when the windows would remain lit up, and after a trip to the Marquee, I would walk around all night, looking and dreaming. When I finally bought the Gibson, I just couldn't believe how shiny and beautiful it was. At last, I felt like a real musician. The truth is, I was taking myself far too seriously and becoming very critical and judgmental of anybody in music who wasn't playing just pure blues. This attitude was probably part of my intellectual phase. I was reading translations of Baudelaire and discovering the American underground writers like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, while simultaneously watching as much French and Japanese cinema as I could. I began to develop a real contempt for pop music in general, and to feel genuinely uncomfortable about being in the Yardbirds. No longer were we going in the direction I wanted, mainly because, seeing the runaway success of the Beatles, Giorgio and some of the guys had become obsessed with getting on TV and having a number one record. It's quite possible that Giorgio was still smarting from having lost the Stones, but what was clear was that we weren't moving upward fast enough, so each of us was told to go out there and find a hit song. Actually, I had no problem with having a hit, as long as it was a song we could be proud of. Funnily enough, Giorgio had played me a song by Otis Redding called "Your One and Only Man" several months before. It was a catchy song which I felt we could do a version of without selling ourselves short. Then Paul Samwell Smith came up with a song called "For Your Love" by Graham Gouldman, later of 10cc, which was clearly a number one. I balked, but the others all loved it, and that was that. When the Yardbirds decided to record "For Your Love," I knew it was the beginning of the end for me, as I didn't see how we could make a record like that and stay as we were. It felt to me that we had completely sold out. I played on it, though my contribution was limited to a very short blues riff in the middle eight section, and as a consolation they gave me the B-side, an instrumental called "Got to Hurry," which was based on a tune hummed by Giorgio, who gave himself the writing credit under the pseudonym O. Rasputin. By then I was a pretty grizzled and discontented individual. I deliberately made myself as unpopular as I could by being constantly argumentative and dogmatic about everything that came up. Eventually Giorgio called me to his office in Soho and told me that it was quite clear that I was no longer happy in the band, and that if I wanted to leave then he wouldn't stand in my way. He didn't exactly fire me. He just invited me to resign. Totally disillusioned, I was at that point ready to quit the music business altogether. John Mayall. Initially, I was distraught after leaving the Yardbirds. I felt much as I did when I was thrown out of art school, and the reality finally kicked in. but in a short time my equilibrium came back, and I was able to pat myself on the back for sticking to my principles, even though I wasn't really sure quite what my principles were. For Your Love was a huge hit, and nobody on the outside could understand why I had chosen such a moment to quit when the band was on the up. But the truth is, I felt it was a dreadful waste of what had potentially been a good rock blues band. For a time I returned to live in Ripley, feeling shy, frightened, and disheartened by a business in which everyone seemed to be on the make, and selling out, rather than being in it for the music. For a while I stayed with Rose and Jack, who were both very supportive of me. By then I think they knew I was serious about what I was doing and had decided to stand behind me. I had a West Indian girlfriend around this time, Maggie, who was a dancer on Top of the Pops, and one night she and I went down to Ronnie Scott's club in Soho to meet up with a friend of mine, Tony Garland. Tony was a fellow music fan I used to hang out with at the Marquee, and in the early days he was the first person I ever saw wearing flared trousers. He had made them himself by sewing triangular inserts into his Levi's. On that particular night he was with a great-looking girl, June Child, who was obviously smart as a whip and very, very funny. She and I got talking and laughing, and she was taking the mickey out of Tony, whom she kept referring to as Wanker Garland, and I started to join in. This was much to the annoyance of Maggie, who was more accustomed to getting all the attention, and the result was that by the end of the evening we had swapped partners. I left the club with June, who instantly became one of my best friends. We did not become lovers, however. I really enjoyed her company as a friend and didn't want to spoil it. I'm pretty sure she wanted to go down that road, but at that point I hadn't figured out that it was possible to fancy a girl and also be friends with her. Sex was still a matter of conquest, rather than the result of a loving relationship. The idea simply never occurred to me that you could have an intelligent conversation with a girl and then sleep with her. Retrospectively, I kind of regret that we never got it together, as I'm sure we would have had a great time. June not only became my pal, she also, since I couldn't drive, became my voluntary chauffeur. One day I asked her to take me to Oxford to visit Ben Palmer, the keyboard player with the Roosters. Ben was an incredibly charismatic man, very funny, very intelligent, and very worldly and wise, with strong, angular, rather aristocratic features that made him look as if he came from the 18th century. He was a creative man of great depth who could turn his skill in any direction. He was then living in a studio above some stables where he had taught himself wood carving, and when we arrived he was putting the finishing touches on a Tang horse. He said he had given up the piano completely. Ben was the only other person I knew who was as fanatically purist about the blues as I was, and I tried to talk him into doing something with me. I thought maybe we could produce a guitar and piano blues record, but he steadfastly refused. To begin with, I felt very depressed, and for a few weeks Ben looked after me like an older brother, keeping an eye on me and cooking me delicious meals. He also introduced me to The Lord of the Rings, which I spent hours reading. In the meantime, June had given Ben's number to John Mayle, a blues musician with a credible reputation and leader of his own band, the Blues Breakers. He called and asked if I might be interested in joining his outfit. I knew who he was from the Marquee, and I admired him because he was then doing exactly what I always thought we could have done with the Yardbirds. He had found his niche and was staying there, touring good clubs and making the odd record without ever really going for broke. The fact that I didn't really like the two singles he'd made, Crawling Up a Hill and Crocodile Walk, which to me were like pop R&B, was immaterial, because what I saw was a frame that I could fit into. I wasn't sure about the way he sang or the way he presented himself, but I was very grateful that someone saw my worth, and my thinking was that maybe I would be able to steer the band toward Chicago blues instead of the sort of jazz blues that the band was currently playing. He seemed happy to go along with this. I think that until I came along, he had been quite isolated in his musical tastes, and now he'd found someone just as serious about the blues as he was. I joined the Blues Breakers in April 1965. I went to live with John in his house in Lee Green, which he shared with his wife, Pamela, and their children. 12 years older than me, with long curly hair and a beard, which gave him a look not unlike Jesus, he had the air of a favourite schoolmaster who still manages to be cool. He didn't drink, and was a health food fanatic, the first proper vegetarian I had ever met. Trained as a graphic artist, John made a good living as an illustrator of things like science fiction books, and he worked as well for advertising agencies, but his real passion was music. He played piano, organ, and rhythm guitar, and he had the most incredible collection of records I had ever seen, with rare singles of songs you otherwise find only on compilation albums. Many of these were ordered through Blues Unlimited, a specialist magazine run by blues fan Mike Ledbetter. I had a tiny little cupboard room at the top of John's house, barely big enough for a narrow single bed, and over the better part of a year, when I had any spare time, I would sit in this room listening to records and playing along with them, honing my craft. Modern Chicago blues became my new mecca. It was a tough electric sound, spearheaded by people like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, who had come up from the Delta to record for labels like Chess. The leading guitar players of this genre were Otis Rush, Buddy Guy, Elmore James, Hubert Sumlin, and Earl Hooker, to name a few. It perfectly suited our lineup of guitar, bass, drums, and keyboard. John played piano, Hammond organ, and rhythm guitar. On drums we had Huey Flint, who would go on to form a band with Tom McGinnis called McGinnis Flint. I played lead guitar, and the bass player was John McVie, who later formed Fleetwood Mac with Mick Fleetwood. Not only was he a brilliant bass guitarist, but he was an incredibly funny man, with a very dark, cynical sense of humour. At that time, the two Johns and myself were obsessed with the Harold Pinter play The Caretaker. I had seen the film, with Donald Pleasance as the tramp Davies, as many times as I could, and I had also bought the script, a lot of which I knew by heart. We would spend hours acting out scenes from the play, swapping roles, so that sometimes I would play the character of Aston, other times Davies or Mick, and we would piss ourselves with laughter. To begin with, since Mayle was that much older than the rest of us, and was, to our minds, a respectable middle-class man living with a wife and kids in suburbia, the dynamics of the band were very much him and us. We saw him in the role of schoolmaster, with us as the naughty boys. He was tolerant up to a point, but we knew there was a limit, and we did our best to push him to it. We would take the mickey out of him behind his back, telling him he couldn't sing, and giggling when he went out on stage bare to the waist. He was a well-built man, and more than a little vain, and we liked to see just how far we could go before he lost his temper. John didn't like alcohol around when we were working, and unfortunately McVie, who was our spokesman, liked to drink a lot. This would often lead to some form of confrontation, and one of them would lose it. Lovable though McVie was, there were often times when his drinking made him aggressive, and he would either be left behind or, as on one occasion when we were returning from a gig up north, actually turfed out of the van. Less than a month after I joined the Blues Breakers, John asked me to go down to a studio to play on some tracks he'd been asked to work on with Bob Dylan. He was very excited about this, as Dylan, who was over to tour England, had specially asked to meet him after hearing his song Crawling Up a Hill. My feelings about Dylan at the time were rather ambivalent, coloured by the fact that Paul Samwell Smith had been a big fan of his, and anything Paul liked, I didn't. So I went down to the studio where the session was taking place and was introduced to Bob and his producer, Tom Wilson. Unfortunately, I wasn't open to any of it at the time. I hadn't really listened to any of Bob's stuff, and was developing a healthy prejudice toward him, based, I suppose, on what I thought of the people who did like him. As far as I was concerned, Dylan was a folky. I couldn't understand all the fuss, and it seemed like everyone around him was patronizing him to death. However, one person in his entourage whom I did take to instantly was Bobby Neuwirth. I think he was a painter or a poet. It seemed like he was Dylan's pal, but he took the time to talk to me and tried to clue me in on what was going on. I'm not sure it did any good. I was like Mr. Jones in Ballad of a Thin Man. But it was the beginning of a lifelong friendship. I don't remember Dylan talking to anybody. Maybe he was shy like me. As for the session, I don't remember much about it. I don't think any of the songs got finished, and then Bob suddenly disappeared. When somebody asked where he was, we were told, "Oh, he's gone to Madrid." I didn't think much about Bob Dylan for a while, and then I heard Blonde on Blonde, and thank goodness I finally got it. The moment I said yes to John, I joined a working schedule the likes of which I had never experienced. If there had been 8 nights a week, we'd have played them, as well as 2 shows on Sunday. Our bookings were handled by 2 brothers, Rick and Johnny Gunnell, who owned the Flamingo Club on Wardour Street, a tiny basement club that was the most authentic soul music venue in London. Both edgy and cliquey, it catered to tough, mostly black audiences who were hardcore R&B, blues and jazz followers. The Gunnels represented a lot of the bands who played the London nightlife circuit, people like Georgie Fame, Chris Farlow, Albert Lee and Gino Washington. Rick and Johnny were a couple of lovable rogues who represented the soft side of the London underworld at the time, enjoying good relations with the police so they could keep their club open till 6 a.m. They had their own territory, and were treated with respect by gangland figures like the Crays. John, the younger of the two and very good-looking, had a big scar across his face from where he'd presumably been bottled. His elder brother Rick used to get very drunk and would walk in and demand of the entire club, "Why aren't the band playing?" Though undoubtedly tough guys, they were music lovers too, and always very kind to me, possibly because they realized how seriously I took the music. Another club I used to hang out in was The Scene in Windmill Yard, run by Ronan O'Reilly, who went on to set up Radio Caroline, England's first pirate radio station. I used to watch and finally made friends with a small group of guys who hung out there and had a big influence on how I wanted to look at the time. They wore a hybrid of American Ivy League and the Italian look, as personified by Marcello Mastroianni. So on one day they might be wearing sweatshirts with baggy trousers and loafers, on another maybe linen suits. An interesting bunch because they seemed to be miles ahead of anyone else in terms of style. I found them fascinating. This group, all from the East End, included Laurie Allen, a jazz drummer, Jimmy West and Dave Foley, who were tailors and went on to start a business making suits for people like me, called The Workshop, on Berwick Street, and Ralph Berenson, a natural comedian and mimic. I would sometimes play at The Scene, and one night I was approached and asked to go and play a gig at another club called Esmeralda's Barn, a nightclub in Mayfair owned by the Cray brothers. It was a weird evening, because I played with the resident band, and there was no one else in the club except the Crays, sitting at a table right at the back, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing there. It felt like an audition. We were paid £35 a week to play with the Blues Breakers, which we used to collect from the Gunnels' office in Soho. It was a set wage, no matter how much work we did, and though there may have been a ruckus from time to time from other members of the band about trying to get an increase, I don't remember really caring about it, because my expenses were very small. I was usually on the cadge, rarely paying for anything, and living free. We certainly earned our money. The idea was that we would play a gig, and when we were done, we might have to play again that night. Every Saturday they had an all-nighter at the Flamingo, at which we were regulars, which was fine if we were playing Oxford or somewhere not too far away, but quite grueling if the earlier show was in Birmingham, which necessitated making an exhausting trip back down the M1. Travelling to these, what seemed to us then, faraway places, was important, as there was only so much work in the home counties, and it was essential for bands to play in the better-known clubs in the north in order to get recognition and consolidate their following. To name a few, there was the Twisted Wheel in Manchester, the Club A-Go-Go in Newcastle, the Boathouse in Nottingham, the Starlight in Redcar, and the Mojo in Sheffield, where Peter Stringfellow was DJ. The concept of paying someone to play records in a club until the band came on was then entirely new, and he was one of the original DJs, playing really good sounds, mostly blues and R&B. It was exciting to go to different parts of the country. Girls were everywhere, which meant I was having a pretty extraordinary sex life, dating and picking up anyone I could get my hands on. Most of the time it was just innocent groping, and only rarely did it go all the way. In those days you hardly ever had a dressing room, like bands do today. You just got on and off the stage from the audience. So she might be a girl I'd met while walking about before the show, or someone I'd noticed while on stage, and I'd just get talking to her and then go off with her. I remember that I'd always meet a particular girl in Basingstoke. The band would do two sets, with a half-hour interval, and I'd see this girl after the first set and go off with her somewhere backstage, and come back on stage with the knees of my jeans covered in dust from the floor. This was quite normal, part of the geography of touring. Bishop Stortford, Sheffield, Windsor, Birmingham. For us it wasn't a girl in every port, it was a girl at every gig, and the girls themselves seemed to be quite happy to have that kind of relationship, seeing me only occasionally. I can't say I blame them. We also loved to travel around England because we knew that was as far as we were going to get. No one would ever have thought of sending us to Ireland or Scotland, because they weren't going to pay for hotels, so we had to get back home after the gig. Though it's difficult to imagine it now, going to Newcastle then was for me like going to New York. It seemed like another world. I didn't understand a word people said, and the women were really fast and quite scary. A not untypical night might involve travelling up to Sheffield to play the evening gig at 8 o'clock, then heading off to Manchester to play the all-nighter, followed by driving back to London and being dropped off at Charing Cross Station at 6 in the morning. We travelled in John's Ford Transit. Back in the 60s, a lot of rank was attached to the kind of van a band had. A Bedford Dormobile, ugly and clunky and with sliding doors, denoted lowly standing, but owning a transit showed that you were at the top of the pile. They had powerful engines and really zipped along, meaning you could do a fair amount of mileage in them, and they were big inside and comfortable. The multi-talented John, also a bit of an inventor, had tailor-made the interior of the transit to his own design. This entailed making a special space to carry his Hammond B3 organ, which was rigged up so it could be carried on two poles like a sedan chair. Then, in the space between the organ and the roof of the van, he had built himself a bunk bed. So on return trips from faraway places like Manchester or Sheffield, we'd all be sitting in the front of the van on the bench seats while he'd be in the back, asleep in his bed. Apart from once or twice, we never stayed in a bed and breakfast or a hotel. The most we could hope for was, if we were playing in Manchester, where John's family came from, he might invite us to stay in one of the family homes. I did this once, and it was pretty lugubrious, although it was better than sitting up all night in the van. It was an incredible life, and at times I didn't believe it was happening. One night, for example, Mike Vernon, who owned Blue Horizon Records, asked me to go down to a studio to do some session work, and I found myself playing with Muddy Waters and Otis Spann, two of my all-time heroes. I was absolutely terrified, but not because I felt that I couldn't carry my weight, musically. I just didn't know how to behave around these guys. They were incredible. They had these beautiful, baggy silk suits on and were so sharp. And they were men. And here I was, a skinny young white boy. But it was fine. We cut a song called Pretty Girls Everywhere I Go, and I played lead over Muddy's rhythm while Otis sang and played piano. I was in heaven, and they seemed pretty happy with what I did. At this point, people began to talk about me as if I were some kind of genius, and I heard that someone had written the slogan, Clapton is God, on the wall of Islington Underground Station. Then it started to spring up, all over London, like graffiti. I was a bit mystified by this, and part of me ran a mile from it. I didn't really want that kind of notoriety. I knew it would bring some kind of trouble. Another part of me really liked the idea that what I had been fostering all these years was finally getting some recognition. The fact is, of course, that through my playing, people were being exposed to a kind of music that was new to them, and I was getting all the credit for it, as if I had invented the blues. As for technique, tons of white American guitar players were better than me. Apart from the famous blues guys, there were a lot of white players too. Reggie Young, for example, a Memphis session player, was one of the best guitarists I had ever heard. I had seen him playing with a Bill Black combo on the Ronettes package tour. Don Peake, who I saw play with the Everly Brothers, and James Burton, who played on Ricky Nelson's records, were two others. English guitarists I had seen who had knocked me out were Bernie Watson and Albert Lee. They both played with Screaming Lord Such's band, the Savages. Bernie and Such's pianist, Andy Wren, were supreme musicians, far ahead of everyone else at the time. I remember hearing them play Worried Life Blues, the Big Masio song, and Bernie was bending notes which he had been doing long before anybody. Though I rated Jeff Beck and also Jimmy Page, their roots were in rockabilly, while mine were in the blues. I loved what they did, and there was no competitiveness between us. We just played different styles. But another part of me thought the Clapton is God thing was really quite nice. I'd been ousted from the Yardbirds, and they'd brought in Jeff Beck. They immediately had a string of hits, and I was quite put out by that, so any kind of accolade that came from just playing, without selling myself or promoting myself on TV, was welcome. There's something about word of mouth that you cannot undo. In truth, I felt grateful about it because it gave me status, and even better, it was a kind of status nobody could tamper with. After all, you can't mug around with graffiti. It comes from the street. By the early summer of 1965, though I was still living in John's house in Lee Green, I was spending a lot of time with a group of friends hanging out in a flat in Longacre, Covent Garden, owned by a woman named Clarissa, who was the girlfriend of Ted Milton. Ted was the most extraordinary man. a poet and visionary whom I first met at Ben Palmer's. He was the first person I ever saw physically interpreting music. We were at home, at Ben's house, and after dinner he put on a Howlin' Wolf record and began to enact it with his entire being, dancing and employing facial expressions to interpret what he was hearing. Watching him, I understood for the first time how you could really live music, how you could listen to it completely and make it come alive so that it was part of your life. It was a real awakening. Ted and Clarissa lived in a second-floor flat which consisted of several rooms opening off a long corridor and a big kitchen, and it was the centre of our lives for a while. The cast of characters included John Bailey, known to us as Dapper Dan for his suave good looks and natty sense of dress, who was studying anthropology. Bernie Greenwood, a doctor with a clinic in Notting Hill, who was also a great saxophone player. Mikko Milligan, a jeweller and part-time hairdresser. Peter Jenner and Andrew King, who lived in a flat opposite and were just starting to manage Pink Floyd. And my old friend, June Child, who now had a job working for them as their secretary. Looking back on it, we had the time of our lives, drinking, smoking massive quantities of dope, and believing that everything we were doing was totally original. And sometimes it was. While poor old Clarissa went out to work to pay for it all. Bit by bit, this scene began to take up more and more of my spare time. It was outrageous, really. We'd just spend hours and hours listening to music and drinking Mathieu's Rosé, real headache material, which I absolutely loved. Sometimes we'd get into spontaneous laughing jags, brought on by God knows what, where we'd latch on to a particular word or phrase or on something we'd seen, and we'd just start laughing hysterically, and it would become unstoppable. We could literally laugh for hours at a time. Laughing was also part of another pastime, where we'd listen to one song over and over for a whole day. A favourite was Shotgun by Junior Walker, before passing out and then start again when we came round. In the middle of the summer of 65, six of us spontaneously decided to get a band together and drive round the world, financing the trip by playing gigs along the route. We called ourselves The Glands. John Bailey would be the vocalist, with Bernie Greenwood on sax. Ted's brother Jake would play drums. Ben Palmer was lured back to the piano, and on bass we had Bob Ray. Bernie's car, an MGA, was traded in for an American Ford Galaxy station wagon to serve as our transport, while I had a few hundred quid in wages saved up, with which I bought an amplifier and a